What we're going to do in this last session of today is to focus on tackling discrimination. So if you bear in mind that our theme for the day is how organisations can go wrong, then treating sections of that organisation unfairly is clearly not something organisations are supposed to do. And so what we're going to do is to look at, first of all, discrimination in general is just like a refresher, in a sense, you know, to get the ideas about discrimination fresh in your mind. Then I'll give you a very quick historical overview about some of these issues, because I think it's important to put them in historical context to understand them. And then once we've done that, we'll then think about how do these issues about discrimination then apply to the workplace? How do they apply to professionalism, for example? So that's the way we're going to tackle it. So we'll begin with just sort of recapping on some key issues about discrimination. Now, to do that, what I'm going to do is to look at what I think are five key words in terms of discrimination. The first one is diversity. Now, of course, as you're probably aware, diversity means variety. So to say that we live in a diverse society means that we live in a society that is varied, that there are different people with different backgrounds. And if you think about it, our society is very diverse. It's interesting that people tend to focus on what we've got in common. They'll tend to focus on commonalities, but not recognise that there are also significant differences across groups of people. And we haven't got time to do it, and I'm not sure it'd be a useful use of our time anyway. But, you know, if we were to go around the room and look at, you know, what are the differences between people, we could probably come up with a long list of differences, even in a group like yourselves where you've got so much in common. So I want to emphasise two points about diversity. The first one is that we live and work in a diverse society. Don't underestimate how much difference there is in our society. So even in areas, for example, where the population are predominantly white, there will still be significant differences across groups within that area, within that community. There may be Polish people, there may be Jewish people, there may be Irish people, all sorts of people who potentially could experience discrimination. But there'll be all sorts of other differences as well in terms of sexuality, for example. So sometimes it can be misleading. People think, well, you know, such and such an area is a predominantly white area, so diversity is not an issue. Whereas diversity will be an issue for any group of people, any community. Now, the other thing I wanted to emphasise about diversity is, basically, it's a good thing. Sadly, some people see diversity as a problem to be solved. You know, what are we going to do about the problem of diversity? Whereas in reality, it's not a problem, it's an asset. It's a benefit to us. Think what life would be like, for example, if we were all the same. Just imagine if you all dressed exactly the same, you all liked the same music, you all ate the same food, you all had the same political opinions, you all, well, be hard to distinguish amongst you, you'd just be like clones of one another. Anybody fancy living in a society like that? No. So the idea behind, and this is where we get the phrase valuing diversity, the idea behind valuing diversity is it's that variety, that range of differences amongst us that helps to enrich our society. So we should appreciate, we should value diversity. Some people even go so far as to say we should celebrate diversity. And why not? So that's our starting point, is we live and work in a diverse society, and that diversity is a good thing. It's a positive aspect of our society. Now then, let's have a look at our second word then, which is difference. Now, what would you say is not necessarily your own perspective, but society at large, what would you say is the perspective of society at large towards people who are seen as different? Would you say it's predominantly positive, predominantly negative, or what? Yeah. So there does tend to be, you know, going back to what we were saying yesterday about discourses, can you say how there is a discourse of difference as a problem? Somebody who's different is seen as a problem in a sense. You know, that it is a negative thing when people are different. Now, do you see how we've got a contradiction here? Can you see how we can't have it both ways? We can't say variety is a good thing, but difference is a bad thing. Do you see how that doesn't add up? It's like saying, yeah, diversity is great, as long as nobody's different. Complete contradiction in terms. So in a sense, when it comes to valuing diversity, one of the things we have to do is to unlearn what society teaches us. To unlearn the idea that somebody being different is a problem, is an issue for us, rather than is a benefit that adds to our experience. So it's important that we don't see difference as a problem, that it's part of valuing diversity. Now, the third word then is discrimination, and that follows on nicely from difference, because literally to discriminate means to identify a difference. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. So it can be positive to identify difference. So, for example, if you are driving a car, then it's a good idea to identify the difference between spaces that you can drive into and spaces that are already occupied by cars or people. Do you see what I'm getting at? You don't discriminate between spaces and lack of space, you end up crashing your car. So, of course, we have to identify differences all the time. You have to identify, when you go to eat, you have to identify what is edible and what isn't. Yeah? So identifying differences is not in itself a problem. Where it becomes a problem, where we talk about the need to tackle discrimination, is where the negativity of difference then comes in. So where people identify a difference and then see it as a problem. So it's not just a case of saying, you're different from me, full stop, or better still, you're different from me, isn't that good, we've got diversity. It's a case of saying, you're different from me, therefore you get less than I do, or you can't come in, or I'm going to treat you unfairly because you are different. So can you see the significance of that? That it's not just about literally identifying a difference, but the added value judgment that then goes along with it to say, because that person's different, they get less or they get treated badly or whatever. They get less respect, for example. That's where my fourth word comes in, which is detriment. Now, this is the legal term. To suffer a detriment means you lose out in some way. You're disadvantaged in some way. So can you see how that happens? If you are discriminated against, you are suffering a detriment. So if because of the colour of your skin, because of your gender, because of a disability, because of your sexuality, because of the language you speak, or whatever it may be, if you lose out in some way, purely because of that, then you are suffering a detriment. And that's why we talk about tackling discrimination, to make sure that, in a sense, we're not being unfair to people. Certain people, because they are part of a group that's perceived as different or a minority. Now, that's the legal term, detriment. But I would argue that it's more than just the legal side of things, that from an ethical, value-based point of view and a political point of view, what we're talking about is oppression. When people are especially consistently and systematically discriminated against, then we're not talking about, well, that's a bit unfair. What we're talking about is oppression that can actually ruin people's lives. That's why it's sad when some people don't take anti-discriminatory practice seriously, when they just see it as a sort of a trendy bandwagon, or they just do it, they deal with it in a minimal way to avoid getting into trouble. You know, they do it in a defensive way, but they're not seriously committed to tackling discrimination, because perhaps they're not tuned in to just how significant oppression can be in actually ruining somebody's life. I'll just give you an example. I once ran a course where we were talking about these issues, and there was a man on the course who said, "Okay, Neil, I see what you mean about discrimination. It's not a good thing, but shouldn't we just like learn to live with it, you know, that, and accept that it's not a fair world, and some people will get discriminated against? And don't you think people go overboard and make too much fuss about discrimination?" And I didn't have to say anything, because there was an Asian woman in the group who commented at that point in a way that really made this man rethink what he'd said. She said, "No, I'm sorry, I don't agree with you at all. That is, I completely disagree with that. That it's a serious problem we have to take very, very seriously." And she said, "For example, I recently moved to this area with my family because where we used to live, we had people daubing on our house wall, 'Pakis go home.' And even though the family weren't actually from Pakistan. And also, they had things like people putting human excrement through their letterbox, simply because their family was from a British Asian background." Can you see the contrast there between this sort of what I would call complacency? This, isn't it a bit too much fuss about it? "Yeah, I take your basic point, but don't you think we go over?" See, that's complacency compared with the real life experience of a woman who had encountered oppression and recognised what a serious issue it was through having that experience. So we should never lose sight of that. Never lose sight of the significance of how discrimination as a process leads to oppression as an outcome. Okay. It's not just about minor technical things. It's about significant negative effect on some people's lives as a result of this. And if you think about this from a social work point of view, isn't it the case that pretty much every group of people we deal with in social work are discriminated against? Because some people have this very simplistic idea about anti-discriminatory practice. They think it's about racism. And then they think, "Well, I don't work with black people where I work. There aren't many black people around, so it's not an issue for me." But you see how they're totally missing the point of that, because in social work, pretty much every group of people that we work with are discriminated against in some way. Consider, for example, children in the care system. Do you think they're discriminated against? Very much so. There's a lot of evidence to show discrimination against children in the care system. For example, in schools, when they go to school and they're sort of stigmatised and so on. Do you think there's discrimination against people with mental health problems? Very much so. Discrimination against people with disabilities, whether physical disabilities or learning disabilities. Yeah. Then we've got ageism in relation to older people. Discrimination against young offenders. Do you see that? Wherever you look in social work, you see groups where often a key factor, a defining feature in many cases of their life experience is being discriminated against, being oppressed. So that's why this is serious stuff for us to take into consideration. Now, unfortunately, our track record in it is not as good as it could have been. And that's for historical reasons. So what I'm going to do now is just give you a quick overview of some historical issues, just not for the sake of it, but just to put it in context. What we have seen over the years is, to begin with, you know, if we go back to, say, the 1950s and the 1960s, there was what I would call naive complacency about issues like racism and sexism, discrimination, broadly defined. So you would have, for example, people saying things like, I'm not racist, I'm not sexist, as if that meant it wasn't an issue. Now, what they didn't understand was the idea of institutional discrimination. The idea that discrimination can be built into a system. And I'll say more about that in a little while when we look at how discrimination applies in organisations. So they just had this individualistic view that I'm not racist, I'm not sexist, etc. So it's not an issue, we don't have to worry about it. So it was only in the 1980s, which may seem a long time ago now, but in the history of social work, that's not long ago. It was only in the 1980s that discrimination issues started being taken seriously, that they came onto the agenda. Now, that was to challenge this naive complacency, this, it's not an issue, don't worry about it, when it was very much an issue. And the reason it came onto the agenda was because that traditional view got heavily criticised. And it got heavily criticised by different groups. So, for example, there were black pressure groups that criticised social work at that time for not taking racism seriously. The argument went along the lines of social work is about tackling social problems. One of the most significant social problems in our society is racism. And yet at that time, social work was doing absolutely nothing about racism because of this, I'm not racist, so it's not an issue. Can you see what I mean by that? That's a bit like somebody saying these days, I don't abuse children, so it's not an issue. Not understanding that that's not what it's about. It's not about you. It's about wider society and how wider society systematically distorts the experience of certain minority groups in a negative direction. So black pressure groups started criticising social work at that time for not taking account of racism. And the term that came to be used then, and is still used to this day, although less often, was the idea of being colourblind. Social work was accused of being colourblind. And what that meant was that they just saw people, and whether they were white people or black people, didn't matter. They were just seen as people. So do you see, if you just see people as people, then you are ignoring racism. You don't see the significance. So you would have situations, for example, where you might have, say, a black child who was being bullied at school simply because they're black. In other words, it was racist bullying. What you might have then is a teacher may come along and treat that child, that black child who's being bullied, the same way they would treat a white child who was being bullied. So they were dealing with the bullying, but what weren't they dealing with? The racism, yeah, exactly. Do you see how that's where the phrase, the term colourblind comes in? If you treat the situation as if everybody's the same, there are no differences, then you are not seeing the way these structured inequalities in society have an adverse effect on some people. So there was that criticism from black pressure groups. Also, at around this time in the early days of anti-discriminatory practice being starting to be taken seriously, there were also feminist groups who were quite rightly pointing out that the vast majority of people who use social services are women. The vast majority of people who provide social services are women. And yet the vast majority of people who manage social services and make policy decisions about social services are men. And most social services practice at that time took little or no notice of gender. So it was just, in a sense, reflecting the gender stereotypes that were common at that time. So no recognition, for example, that in terms of mental health, in terms of depression, for example, we can now see that gender-related discrimination is often a key factor in depression in women. Do you see how if you don't take account of gender, you would miss that? You wouldn't see the significance of that. So while black pressure groups were accusing social work, quite rightly, of being colourblind, feminist groups were accusing social work of being genderblind, of not taking account of gender, of just treating people as people, as if it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman in our society. And of course, we now know full well, of course it matters whether you're a man or a woman in our society, because our society treats men and women differently. It has this different level of treating men and women. It would be naive and extreme to say that society treats men and women the same. It clearly doesn't. You know, you can draw up a very long list of ways in which there are inequalities in relation to gender in our society. Around that time as well, or perhaps a little bit later, historically speaking, there was what came to be known as the Disabled People's Movement. And that was where disabled people started getting political and started saying, we want rights, not charity. We don't want your sympathy. We don't want you to patronise us by looking after us. We want you to help empower us so we've got our rights respected, so that we can be as independent as possible and not have to rely on kind-hearted people looking after us. So the social model of disability developed. And you've no doubt come across that idea, you know, that disability isn't about the physical impairment somebody may have, but the way society treats people with physical impairments in an unequal way, by discriminating against them, in effect. So these were lots and lots of criticisms that were coming the way of social workers at that time. But the important thing to recognise was that not only were these criticisms coming forward, but they were coming forward in a very forceful way. It wasn't like a polite criticism of what was going on. It was a very harsh, even though justified, in my view, very harsh, strong criticism of how discriminatory traditional social work was. So social work had to change. Social work had to respond to these significant criticisms. Anti-discriminatory practice was born from that. And unfortunately, we got off to a bad start. Because if you're getting criticised strongly, from left, right and centre, do you think there's a danger you might become defensive? And that's exactly what happened, is the initial form of anti-discriminatory practice in the early days was very defensive. And what you had then was an oversimplified approach to it. So in terms of, for example, fostering, what used to happen in the days of naive complacency was people would say, if a black child comes into care, doesn't matter whether foster carers are black or white, as long as they're loving, caring, good foster carers. Do you see how that's naive complacency? That's basically taking no account of racism. So black pressure groups said, that's inappropriate. Just placing black children with white foster carers is inappropriate in two ways. For one thing, do those white foster carers understand what perhaps today we would call ethnically sensitive practice? Do they understand issues about diet and hair care and perhaps religious observances or cultural issues that may be significant to a black child that white foster carers wouldn't know the first thing about? But the second criticism was, if those foster carers are white and have had no experience of racism, then how can they help to protect a black child from racism in society if they're not tuned into it. So do you see where the criticism was coming from? Was that it was basically naive complacency to say, as long as the foster carers are loving and caring and good foster parents, it doesn't matter whether they're black or white. And black pressure group said, it does matter. Now, the initial response to that was very simplistic and dogmatic. And it was basically, you must not place black children with white foster carers. So for a while, that was like a sort of an edict. It was seen as, it is racist to place black children with white foster carers because you are not giving them the same level of service and support and protection that white children would get with white foster carers. Therefore, it's racist. So, step number one was to ban placement of black children with white foster carers. Now, today, after extensive campaigns over a long period of time, we still have a national shortage of black foster carers. But then, you're going back to this historical development, the early days of anti-discriminatory practice in the 80s, for example, we had even fewer black foster carers than we've got now. Hardly any, in fact. So, you've got black children coming into care. No black foster carers available. You can't place the child with white foster carers because that's deemed racist. So where does the child go if there are no foster carers available? Where might a child go?
Residential.
Yeah, residential care. What is the ethnic mix of the vast majority of children's homes in this country? We're talking predominantly white, aren't we? Do you see what I'm getting at? Can you see the nonsense? We can't place children with white foster carers, that's racist. So we have to place those children in residential care where the vast majority of the staff are probably white anyway. So do you see how we got this nonsensical result from an oversimplified response? Now that's what I mean by dogmatic reductionism. Dogmatic means fixed and rigid, you know, like saying thou shalt not. Yeah, there's no room for debate, no room for negotiation, just like an edict. It is racist to do that. Well, hang on a minute, perhaps we should consider, no, it's racist. That's what I mean by dogmatic. And by reductionism, I mean an oversimplification. Reductionism is the technical term for when you reduce a complex, multi-level phenomenon to a simple, single-level phenomenon that, you know, instead of looking at the complex reality of discrimination, of just saying, it is discriminatory to do this, it's discriminatory to do that. So a gross oversimplification. So this thing about fostering was an example of dogmatic reductionism. What we've learnt since then is a two-pronged approach. So since we learnt the lessons of that dogmatic reductionism, what happens now is that white foster carers have training in ethnically sensitive practice, you know, in learning about different cultures and about diversity and so on, and also have training about how can you protect black children from racism. So that's been one prong, is to boost the understanding of these issues of the white foster carers, and then strong efforts, determined efforts to recruit far more black foster carers. So do you see how that's a much more reasonable, a much more sensible and effective, when it comes to tackling discrimination, approach than this simplistic thou shalt not and oversimplifying complex issues. Another example of dogmatic reductionism would be language and the so-called political correctness. You know this business about, you mustn't say that word, it's racist. You mustn't say that word, it's sexist, and so on. Now, the thing with that dogmatic reductionism in terms of language is what it does is it doesn't appreciate the complexity of language. It doesn't appreciate the complexity of learning either, because just telling people don't use that word without any understanding of why not is hardly likely to be a learning experience for them. So it oversimplifies the nature of language, it oversimplifies the nature of learning, and it oversimplifies the nature of discrimination as well. So it is the idea of political correctness in the sense of just banning certain words is an example of dogmatic reductionism. Now, what we've developed or started to develop since then is what I like to call linguistic sensitivity. And what I mean by linguistic sensitivity is tuning in to when certain forms of language are inappropriate, but not just having an outright simplistic ban. Because some words are problematic in some situations, but not in others. So, for example, if you're in an airport and you saw a sign saying international flights this way and another sign saying domestic flights this way, would you see any problem with that word domestic flights? No, it's a perfectly reasonable word, isn't it? It doesn't discriminate against anybody. It's fine. What if somebody, a man, say, was to be extremely violent towards his wife, and their neighbour rings the police, and the police say, it's a domestic? What does that mean when the police say, it's a domestic? What's implied by it's a domestic? Yeah. Do you see how it's a domestic basically implies it's only a domestic? Yeah. So do you see how it then goes down the priority list? So you might, and to be fair to the police, you know, that they have been taking this very seriously in recent years and tackling this. You know, I don't want to be unfair to anybody, and that includes the police. They have tried to tackle this, but can you see how traditionally using that term domestic implies it's only domestic, it's less important? Because can you see how if it was the other way around, if that man had beaten hell out of his next door neighbour rather than beaten hell out of his wife, and his wife had rung the police, do you see how it's highly unlikely that the police would say it's only a vicious assault? But isn't it's a domestic implying it's only a vicious assault? So do you see how that word domestic is a loaded word, but only in that context? So somebody coming along and saying, here's a list of words you mustn't say. Don't say domestic. So do you see how that is dogmatic reductionism? That is a dogmatic, it's a rigid, oversimplified approach to the issues. And so what we need is not this like politically correct, don't say that word, but a sensitivity to language. Linguistic sensitivity of being aware of when certain forms of language are important because they are in some way stereotyping, they are marginalising certain people, they are stigmatising certain people, and so on. So, the language issue is a good example of how, for ages, there was naive complacency. That people used to come out with language that today we would regard as pretty horrendous. You know, in the 1970s, for example, there used to be television programmes that were sort of on at peak times, sort of, you know, popular viewing that would refer to black people as coons and wogs. Can you see how we've moved on since then? So we've moved away from the naive complacency. But for a while, we went through this period of dogmatic reductionism where people are just told not to say certain words and they didn't have a clue why they weren't supposed to say it. It was just banned. And that just caused confusion and resentment. You know, who are you to tell me what word I shouldn't use if there's no explanation for it? So, what we've seen then is what I like to call a pendulum swing. Historically, we went from one unhelpful extreme of naive complacency, people not taking the issues seriously, to the pendulum swung to the other extreme of this, like, walking on eggshells, where people for a long time, and still a lot of it about, it's not as bad as it used to be, but still this sense of, I don't know what word to say, so I'll keep my mouth shut just in case somebody says, that's racist, that's sexist, that's whatever. That dogmatic reduction is like a culture of fear, where people are not prepared to address issues around discrimination because it wasn't safe to do that. Now, what we need to find, and I think we're beginning to get there, what we need to find is a healthy balance in terms of that pendulum swing. You're not either of the destructive extremes, going from one end, the naive complacency, to the dogmatic reductionism, but finding the healthy balance, which for me is critically reflective practice. So can you see how linguistic sensitivity is part of critically reflective practice? Think about the language you use. Is it helpful? Is it inclusive? Is it empowering? Or is it unhelpful? Does it exclude people? Is it disempowering? Does it stigmatize? Does it stereotype? And if it does, then we don't need to be told what words should be banned. We should be professional enough to know we'd better find different forms of language for expressing those things. So that's the pendulum swing. Naive complacency to dogmatic reductionism. Now, hopefully, we can move forward in terms of critically reflective practice, where we're aware of the issues, we're not being naive and complacent, but we're not having a closed mind and just following the sort of the diktat of people who are telling us how we should respond simplistically to these complex issues. I remember, for example, being at a conference once where there was a speaker talking about these issues. And what he said was, how many of us would be able to go about our business if we didn't have stairs, if we had a ladder? Yeah, so here we are on the first floor of this building. Do you see how it would have affected our life if you couldn't just go up the stairs? There was just a ladder there. And how many people might say, I'm not going up there without somebody holding it, you know, it could be unsafe. How long's that ladder been there? Is it, you know, rotten or rusty or whatever? So do you see how the provision of stairs does not disable the vast majority of people? But if you're a wheelchair user and there's no lift, then the provision of stairs and no lift disables the person in the wheelchair. It's not the fact that they're in a wheelchair that disables them. It's the fact that we don't provide a lift that disables them. Just in the same way that if society didn't provide stairs, it provided ladders, it would disable a lot of people. Yeah, a lot of people who can manage stairs with difficulty wouldn't be able to manage a ladder at all. And like I was suggesting a minute ago, a lot of people might be able to physically manage a ladder, but they wouldn't be prepared to because they're worried about falling off it or it collapsing or something. So, yeah, that's an important point. That's the idea of the social model of disability. And for a long time, people were just oblivious to that and were just like, you know, wrapping people with disabilities in cotton wool and trying to look after them. And then, like I say, the disabled people's movement was about getting political and saying, we don't want that. We want you to help us to be as independent as possible by tackling these social and political barriers, not by looking after us. Yeah. There's some people, for example, argue that disability is nothing to do with social work. That it should be nothing to do with social workers, you know, that it should be like advocates and rights workers who are working with disabled people, that disabled people should need social workers as social workers, because the nature of social work with people with disabilities is, some people argue, fundamentally different from what we're doing with other groups. So, interesting issue there. Can any of you identify with it? You know, in a sense, you're coming in at the tail end of the history. that you may not have experienced this. But, you know, a lot of people who've been around a while in social work will know exactly what this is all about. They will have been there. They will have, you know, lived through the naive complacency and the dogmatic reductionism and the don't say anything because if you say the wrong word, somebody will put a label on you. The moral of the story, if you like, the conclusion that we can draw from this is that what we need to be able to do is avoid the two destructive extremes, yeah? That what we need to do is not ignore these issues, but then not to go overboard on them either. Okay, now, link this to the organisational context and to professionalism. The key issue for me is the idea of institutional discrimination. And what I mean by institutional discrimination is where it's sort of built into the system. Let me give you an example. This is something I mentioned briefly in my anti-discriminatory practice book. Many years ago, there was a local authority that had a lot of black people living in that area. But what they found at one time was that there were a lot of service users in that area who were receiving home care services who were black. And given that there are a lot of black people living in that area, that was no surprise. But what was a surprise was that the home care workforce was almost exclusively white. Now, can you see how people started to get suspicious? They thought there's racism going on here. Because if it was an area where there are very few black people, you wouldn't be surprised that there weren't many black staff. But in an area where there are a lot of black clients, a lot of black people in the community, yet the workforce is almost exclusively white, people got suspicious. So there was an investigation into this. An independent person came in to look at this situation, to investigate the possibility of racism going on. Now you can imagine, can't you, somebody going into a situation like that might be wondering, who's the racist? Is it the home care manager? Is it the personnel or human resources manager? Is it the director of social services? Or perhaps it's all of them. Perhaps they're all racists. But what was found was very, very different from that. That the investigator could find no evidence of personal racism. There was nothing that made him suspect that any of those people had anything against black people. Not a shred of evidence to suggest that. But what he found was institutional racism. Institutional discrimination. And what it was about was the discrimination was built in to their recruitment policy. Because in those days, what they did was they recruited by word of mouth. In other words, if they had vacancies, they would just say to their existing staff, if you know anybody who's interested, tell them to get an application form from wherever and fill it in, you know, the closing date's 2 weeks' time or wherever, and so on. Now, how might that produce racism, do you think? So the way this ended up being a racist outcome was if your existing white workforce is predominantly white, and you recruit by word of mouth, then what you're going to get is them telling their predominantly white relatives, friends, neighbours and so on about the vacancy. What happens to the people living in the black community up the road? They don't hear a word about it. So do you see how black people were being systematically excluded? But it was not a deliberate attempt. It was not personal racism where there was nobody who was saying, we don't want black people in our workforce. It was the system systematically excluded black people. Now that's an important issue about discrimination in general and racism in particular, is it's about outcomes, not intentions. Because some people would say, well, if nobody was intending to discriminate, it wasn't discriminatory, it was just an accident, you know, it was just the way things worked out. But that's not what discrimination is about. Discrimination is about when people suffer a detriment, and that detriment was they were excluded from employment opportunities. And the fact that it was unintentional doesn't stop it being discriminatory. Can you see how that works? So a key lesson in terms of anti-discriminatory practice is it's not about intentions, it's about outcomes. If the outcome is unfair, then it's unfair, and that is discrimination. The fact that nobody intended it to be unfair is not the issue. Now, do you see how that fits with the idea of the naive complacency? For people to say, I never intended to discriminate, well, great, that's good that you never intended to discriminate, but do you see how that doesn't let you off the hook? If the result was that black people lost out, then that is discrimination, and we have to deal with it. We have to address it. And that's why, for example, we talk about anti-discriminatory practice, not non-discriminatory practice. Do you see what I'm getting at? Because non-discriminatory practice, you just say, I don't discriminate. I'm not discriminating, so my practice is not discriminatory. But it's not about saying just that your practice shouldn't be discriminatory. It's about your practice should challenge discrimination when that discrimination is coming from elsewhere. So to ignore issues of discrimination is, in a sense, to condone them. So, for example, working with older people without addressing ageism, without including ageism as part of your assessment, can you see how you could easily then be reinforcing ageist stereotypes without even knowing that you're doing it? And the fact that you didn't intend to do it, well, that's not really relevant because you should have known. That's the idea of awareness raising about discrimination, is you should know whether or not your actions are unfair. So we have to tune into these issues. And that's what organisations have tried to do. And this is the link with the organisational context. Because do you see how institutional discrimination is about discrimination that's built into organisations? So if organisations don't train their adult services staff in anti-ageism, what's the result likely to be? Let's say they employ a lot of staff to work with older people and they don't provide any training on anti-ageism. So the staff going out there are blissfully unaware of ageist stereotypes and ageist oppression. What's the result likely to be if organisations who employ people to work with older people are not providing anti-ageism training? Yeah, naive complacency is going to be the result. In other words, discrimination. Do you see how the organisation may say, but we haven't trained our staff to discriminate? But then the answer to that is you don't have to. If we know that our society is full of stereotypes of older people, full of ageist language, for example, full of, you know, ideas like old dears and wrinklies and things like that, so patronising language like that, if you don't train, say, home carers, that that's not appropriate language, then you can't really blame them when they use that language. So it's the organisation that is then failing in its duty. So the discriminatory outcomes are as a result of the organisation not taking its duties seriously. So that's where we get this term, this concept of institutional discrimination. I had a police officer on a course once, on one of my courses. It was a, you know, multidisciplinary course. And we got talking about discrimination at one point. And during one of the coffee breaks, he came to me and he said, Neil, I think it's unfair, this stuff about discrimination. He said, because, you know, right from when I was a young child, I've always been very strongly anti-racist. You know, I hate racism. It really makes my blood boil when I come across racism. But as a police officer, with these problems that we've been having about racism, we're being accused of institutional racism. And he said, I am not institutionally racist. I am strongly anti-racist. And I had to then explain to him that he'd misunderstood institutional racism. Do you see what I'm getting at? A person cannot be institutionally racist. Only an institution can be institutionally racist. So I had to say to him, nobody's accusing you personally of being racist. You may be racist, you may not. Yeah? Anyone may not be racist in terms of their personal attitudes and values and so on. But if they're oblivious to how their actions disadvantage people from minority ethnic groups, for example, then they're colluding with racism. They're colluding with institutional racism. That links in then with the professionalism. So part of our duty as professionals is that we have to be tuned into these issues, that we cannot just have the naive complacency and say, it's nothing to do with me, my job is to, whatever it is, work with young offenders, to work with older people, and you know, discrimination's got nothing to do with me. Do you see how that is not engaging with our professional duties in terms of, we are part of organisations that could be, and I've used racism as an example, but it doesn't have to be racism. Organisations can be institutionally discriminatory in a whole range of ways. Okay, so lots of issues there about how discrimination is an important thing in terms of the workplace context and in terms of our professionalism. Very soon, I'm going to invite you to break up into what groups you feel comfortable with and think through these challenges. And I use that word advisedly. You know, these are challenging things that to look at, because you know, most if not all of us will have been brought up in a culture that is full of discriminatory assumptions and stereotypes. So in a sense, it's about unlearning what our society has taught us, and that's quite challenging. Well, for me, I mean, parallel example there, and this came up on a training course I was running, and it really was a very powerful moment. It made a lot of people sit up and think, where we were talking about the issues about the significance of language and how we can, if we're not sensitive to it, we can unintentionally be discriminatory. And there was a woman in the group who said that she had a young child, a daughter, I think she said. And when her daughter was about two, she took her out in the buggy, you know, took her out for a walk, took her to the park, let her out of the buggy. She was running around playing, and she got really dirty. And so she then put her back in the buggy. Then they went to a cafe, went and had a drink in a cafe. And as she took her out of the buggy to put her on the chair in the cafe, she noticed how dirty she'd got playing in the park. And she said to her, look at you, you dirty Arab. And at that point, she just noticed that there were two Arabs sitting in the cafe. And she said she'd never seen an Arab in her life before other than on TV or at the cinema. And there were these two Arabs. And they didn't hear what she said, so you know, there was no direct problem in a sense. But it was only when she saw two Arabs sitting there that she thought, what a dreadful thing to say, you dirty Arab. And yet she said, I've been saying it since I was, you know, that high, just got into, look at you, you dirty Arab, without realising the impact of what that means. And as she said, it's a bit like, you know, what you said, you know, not necessarily anti-gay, but not realising the impact of using terminology. She's got nothing against Arabs, but using that terminology is see how it fits in with our communication stuff. Yeah, it was communicating a different message from what she intended. So, yeah, interesting stuff, isn't it? I mean, one example I had of this, you know, just proving how there's no right answer to this. I ran a course on this topic, you know, a full-day course one day, and there were two Irish men on the course, and they didn't know each other until, you know, they only met on that day. And we got onto the subject of Irish jokes. And one person, one of the Irishmen said, they don't bother me, you know, they just like water off a duck's back, they're no problem at all. I don't pay any attention to people saying Irish jokes. And the other Irishman on the course just did not like that at all. He said, no, I'm sorry, but you are part of the problem. You are colluding with this stereotype that Irish people are stupid. Because isn't that the basis of Irish jokes? You know, have you heard the old about the Irishman who did something stupid? Yeah, that's the idea. And he said, you know, that by saying, oh, it doesn't bother me, you're actually condoning the oppression of our country, our people, and so on. And, you know, I had to be, you know, quite conciliatory to stop it getting quite heated, really. But there were two people who had differing perspectives on, you know, what's the appropriate way of dealing with Irish, anti-Irish racism. There isn't like a simple answer, just do this and everything will be fine. Do you see how that's the political correctness oversimplification? Just say this word, not that word, and everything will be fine. What we're doing is we're dealing with issues about ethnic identity. We're dealing with situations that can reflect centuries of oppression and stuff like that. So do you see how the idea that there's a simple answer to it is, you know, woefully naive? And that's the idea of the sensitivity. You know, we have to tune into these issues without becoming so sensitive that we're like paralysed by them, that we're you know, we're frozen about, I don't want to say the wrong thing. Because, to be honest, if you do say the wrong thing, 9 times out of 10, people will be fine with it. You know, they'll say, well, I'm sorry, but I don't like you using that term because, and just say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realise. Fine, no problem. Do you say it's back to the conflict management thing? You've just managed that conflict fine, no problem. But if people are, you know, walking on eggshells, afraid to open their mouth, it just creates tension and problems. And if you go to the other extreme, just open your mouth and let whatever comes out come out, you've also got difficulties. I can't resist giving you an example of this. It's a wonderful example that came up on one of my courses. And I wish, well, it's actually, it was an Open University summer school that I was teaching on many moons ago. And I wish I had it on video because it was superb. There was a woman on that course who just handled it brilliantly. We were talking about these issues and about language and discrimination. And there was a man on the summer school who said, I think it's a load of nonsense, all this PC nonsense about language. What it should be is you just say what you mean, and if people know what you mean, there's no problem. Just say what you mean. Simple as that. I don't know why there's all this fuss about language. And there was a woman on the same summer school who then turned to him and said, do you really believe that? And he said, yeah, just say what you like as long as people know what you mean. And she just then said to him, she turned to him and she said, so in that case, is it all right if I call you shitface? And he didn't like that. He got a little bit upset and said, of course you can't call me that. That's offensive. And she just very calmly said, but you just said you can say what you like as long as people know what you mean. So do you see how that was a brilliant strategy on her part? To just basically say, that is complete nonsense that you can just say what you like as long as people know what you mean. Because what you're saying may be offensive, it may be reinforcing stereotypes, it may be stigmatizing people, maybe excluding people, marginalizing them. You know, language can do a lot of harm if we're not careful. So this, oh, it doesn't matter, just say what you mean. Do you see how that was, again, an oversimplification of some complex issues for this? They are political issues with a small p and a capital P. So we have to be sensitive to them and work our way through them. For me, they're a bit like grief issues. Do you know, if you went on a course about grief and you expected to be told, this is how you deal with somebody who's grieving. First do this, second do that, third, that's the end of it. 3-step process to deal with people with grief. Away you go, you now know to deal with people with grief. Do you see how that would be a gross oversimplification? That there's no easy answer. It's about being sensitive, being tuned in, using your skills to work with people, to move forward constructively. So do you see how issues, I'm conscious of the time, you know, we're running out of time, and make this the last point. Do you see how that then applies in terms of discrimination? That there's no easy answers like say this word, don't say that word, or do this, don't do that. What it's about is critically reflective practice of engaging with these issues and trying to move forward, not losing sight of our values about valuing diversity, promoting equality, treating people with respect, and so on and so forth. Does that make sense? Yeah, do you see where I'm coming from? No easy answers. We've got to wrestle with these issues, but that's what critically reflective practice is about. Okay, thanks very much for your efforts.